20th century physics began around 600 BC, when Pythagoras, this bald-headed fellow here, made an extraordinary discovery. He discovered that the musical notes, which sound to be in harmony to us, are related by simple numerical ratios. If you take a long string and pluck it, holding down the middle, compared to not holding down the middle, you get an octave. You get the ratio of 2 to 1 of the wavelengths. And that sounds like a harmony to us. If you hold it down in different ratios, in ratios of 3 to 2, you get something that sounds like a harmony. The fifth, 4 to 3, the fourth, 5 to 4, a third, and so forth. Whereas if you hold down some random ratio, you get some notes that don't sound well together. So this, he thought, it was a deep correspondence between mathematical concepts, mathematical idealizations, and things we find in the world. And generalizing from this experience, he proposed that all things are numbers. That you could get its from bits, the things that you see around you in the world reflect properties of numbers, even whole numbers, but in any case, numbers and concepts. This idea shouldn't get to the eclipse yet. This idea inspired many people, perhaps reaching its apotheosis, or its temporary apotheosis, in the career of Johannes Kepler. We teach our students in freshman physics or astronomy Kepler's three laws of planetary motion. What's less famous is that there was a zeroth law of planetary motion that Kepler proposed before any of the others, and that so excited him that it started his whole career in astronomy, turned him away from astrological pursuits. And the reason we don't teach it is that it's wrong. But it was very Pythagorean. It was the idea that the distances of the different planets from the sun could be explained in purely geometrical terms. Again, the idea of getting realities from concepts without having to make any reference to measurements or mundane accidental facts about the world. You see his idea in this model, which there's actually a beautiful wooden realization of this in a museum in Hamburg, I believe. His idea was that the orbits of the planets, thank you, that planets moved around on spheres, and the sizes of these spheres were just such that they would fit inside and outside a series of regular polyhedra, the so-called Platonic solids. There are exactly 5 Platonic solids. There's the tetrahedron, the cube, the octahedron, the icosahedron with 20 sides, and the dodecahedron, which is what you see with calendars, has 12 sides. And this fit the known number of planets at that time. And Kepler somehow convinced himself that the sizes of the planetary orbits more or less fit this system. That converted him to Copernicanism, the idea that the sun was at the center and planets revolved around it, and inspired him to take up a career in astronomy. He got so carried away by this Pythagoreanism, that he even had a theory of the sounds that the spheres emit as they revolve. And in his book, you actually find this, the music of the spheres. But Kepler was a great scientist and an honest man. And his three laws that he found, that the ones that we still teach, made the first one, or made the zeroth law, obsolete. I mean, one of his laws was that, first of all, the planets move in ellipses, so these spheres don't work. And even though it was they're only a little bit different from circles, he had to abandon his scheme. And after that, it only got worse. With the classic work of Newton, where celestial mechanics was understood in the modern way, we learned that the sizes and shapes of planetary systems are somewhat accidental. They have to do with the origins of the planetary systems. If some star came nearby our solar system and shoved the planets around, then the solar system would just have a different shape forever afterwards. And now we even know that as an experimental fact, because people are starting to observe distant solar systems, distant planetary systems around distant stars, and see that they don't look necessarily at all like our solar system. So in Newtonian dynamics, we learned that this kind of question why do the planetary orbits have the size and shape they do is not a question we should ask in physics. We should ask, given their positions and velocities at one time, what's their position and velocity is going to be at a later time? So very un-Pythagorean, you don't see references to whole numbers or shapes. And certainly nothing unique, nothing that would determine uniquely the structure of solar systems or, for that matter, matter of any kind. And there it stood for about 250 years, from roughly 1650 to the early parts of the 20th century. When Pythagoreanism started to make a big comeback, thanks largely to this fellow, aided and abetted by his wife. That's Niels Bohr. Niels Bohr postulated a model of atoms that Einstein, continuing our theme of Pythagoreanism and the relation of physics to music, called the highest form of musicality in the sphere of thought. And it also connects to Kepler's ideas, his discredited zeroth law. It would be interesting to know if Bohr was thinking of that at all when he made his model. But in any case, his model, his original atomic model, was based on attraction, 1 over r squared type of attraction, just like you have in gravity, between a positively charged nucleus and negatively charged electrons, so a kind of solar system. But then he also supplied rules that said that only certain orbits were allowed, precisely what Kepler had tried to do for planets. But Bohr's theory, as he well knew, contradicted the principles of physics as then known, and was basically based on direct confrontation with the data. It was only he identified this kind of mathematical model with facts about atoms. In fact, the facts about atoms that he was able to address are summarized in this picture and this formula. When you put light through a gas of hydrogen, you find that certain frequencies of the light, certain colors, get absorbed. Those are the black lines in this spectrum. And what Bohr did was supply rules for the position of those lines. I won't go into the details of relating those positions to the concrete formula, but here is the formula. And I do want to point out an important distinction here, or an important feature of this formula that it distinguishes two kinds of things that appear in it, the blue ones and the red ones. Okay. The blue ones are Pythagorean. They are things that are either pure numbers or what I call honorary numbers. Four, that's clearly a number. Pi, that's a number. These n1s and n2s are supposed to be integers, so there's one line for each whole number combination of n1 and n2. So far it's all whole numbers and well, not whole numbers, but numbers. In any case, nothing that is not purely conceptual, not purely an idea, and yet it's describing very concrete reality. C, the speed of light, you might say, well, that is something that has to be measured. That's not conceptual. However, in a sense, it should be called an honorary number, because we have a deep theory, the special theory of relativity, which relates by symmetries space and time. It tells us that what you call space and what you call time depend on how fast you're moving along, and any observer moving along at a constant velocity has an equally valid description of physics. So you need some way of changing space into time. But space and time are measured in different units. One is measured in centimeters, one is measured in seconds. So to implement this idea, you need some kind of conversion factor that tells you how long a centimeter is in seconds. And that's the speed of light. So that's C. And so C has a deep conceptual basis. It's a conversion factor between time and space. Similarly, H bar, Planck's constant, is an honorary number. In quantum theory, there's a proportionality between energy and frequency of oscillations. I'm not going to give you a formal lecture on quantum mechanics, but that's just the case, that there are frequent oscillations of wave functions in time that are associated with energy. But just like space and time are measured in different units, energy and speed of oscillation, or frequency, are measured in different units. And for the theory to make sense, you have to calibrate your units. You have to know how to measure energy in terms of frequency. And so this honorary number should be thought of as something analogous to converting feet into yards or centimeters into meters. It's a conversion factor. It's an honorary number. It's purely conceptual within the definition of quantum mechanics. Okay. So all these blue things realize the Pythagorean ideal in an extraordinary way. To complete the description of atoms, we need, however, some elements of reality that aren't purely conceptual. There's the so-called fine structure constant, which tells us how powerful the attraction is between electrons and protons, and we just have to take that from experiment. It's a measured quantity. It's not purely conceptual. And then there are the masses of the protons and electrons that also appear in this formula. So that's Me and Mp. However, you'll notice that really Mp, since Mp, the mass of the proton, is much larger than the mass of the electron, it almost cancels between the top and the bottom. Okay. On the top, you have a factor of Mp. On the bottom, you have a factor of Mp plus Me. So if Mp is much bigger, those almost all cancel, and really only all that occurs is the mass of the electron. This turns out to be completely general. You can account for the sizes and shapes of all atoms using only purely conceptual things, the mass of the electron, and the fine structure constant. To do that, you have to go a little bit beyond, well, a lot beyond Bohr's original idea. You have to move from thinking of atoms as planetary systems with particles orbiting around as in a solar system to thinking, as we learned to do in quantum mechanics, as particles of being, as being waves, as being continuously distributed. And one can calculate in quantum mechanics the different possible patterns that waves can undergo. These waves can undergo stable oscillations. And there's this, a marvelous shareware program called Atoms in a Box, which I show you here, only for Mac. Which enables you to visualize the structure and the oscillations of different excitations of atoms, of hydrogen atoms. So what in the Bohr theory would be different orbits corresponds to different structures here. You can sort of see orbits emerging, but it's only an approximation in the complete quantum theory. And these are real calculations going on in real time. It's an incredible hack, this thing, of how the electron wave functions change. And the process whereby light is emitted is a quantum jump when you change from one structure to the other. And we can play microcosmic God by picking out a jump. And there it goes. And as I, this is very similar mathematically and conceptually to the fact that if you have a drum and hit it in different ways, with different parts of it nailed down, say, you get different kinds of oscillations. Or if you, well, all musical instruments work this way. If you blow into a horn or hit a gong in different places, you get different notes. And this is the same mathematics. It's really, as I said, you can really get immense feeling of power. You can stop atoms in their track, or you can make them spin. Here. Of course, that's not what the atoms really. That's what the atoms would do if you were spinning your axes like that. Okay. So the ideas that I wanted to get across with that are two. First of all, that you get an enormous amount from very little, just from pure concepts. And exactly two numbers that you have to take from experiment, you can determine all these wave patterns, all these sizes and shapes of atoms. And in fact, you can do all of chemistry, all of a very limited part of chemistry. You can do all of chemistry where things don't move. Because when you're taking the mass of the proton to be very large, that means it can't move. But as far as the shapes of things are concerned, chemical bonds and so forth, it's all in there with just these two measured quantities. So that's why I say the numerical recipe for atoms and structural chemistry has two ingredients. Okay. But now we have to improve on Bohr by addressing this question of, well, what about the mass of the proton? What about the atomic nuclei? We do want things to move, after all. We know that they do in nature. Well, the first great development in understanding that was to understand that all atomic nuclei, all these centers of atoms, where most of the mass and all the positive charge is concentrated, are made out of particles called protons and neutrons. And for many purposes, we can just regard protons and neutrons as basic particles and build up atomic nuclei from those. And that gives a pretty good working theory, and it's probably the kind of theory that, well, it definitely is the kind of theory that you see in high school textbooks. That's kind of where they stop. But physicists didn't stop there. Physicists, by now, had become much more ambitious, much more Pythagorean, want to get as much as possible from as little as possible, reduce things to concepts. Also, physicists want to do justice to reality. So people did experiments to find out whether protons really were simple objects. This requires very special apparatus, very, very specialized, high-powered microscopes that look like two-mile-long accelerators. Well, they are two-mile-long accelerators. And you need that kind of energy to get enough resolving power to look inside protons. When people did, they found out that protons do have insides and do have structures inside, so that an account of nature based on protons and neutrons being the ultimate particles is clearly inadequate. Furthermore, they found out by experiments that there were many, many more particles than just protons and neutrons with similar properties. When you bang together protons and neutrons, many, many things pop out, including antiprotons, antineutrons, but also lambda particles, rho mesons, pi mesons, k mesons, all kinds of stuff, which all of which looks in many ways similar to protons and neutrons. The only reason we're not familiar with them is that they're highly unstable and decay on humanly short timescales. So there's a whole zoo of particles. So protons are not simple, and furthermore, there's a whole zoo of particles that we should, understanding protons and neutrons is too narrow a question. There's a whole zoo of particles that are all related that come up in the exploration. Well, it's a long and fascinating story how people came up with a theory that described all this. Tremendous ingenuity was involved. Intellects of the caliber of David Gross had to address this question and took years to succeed. But fortunately, in many ways, the answer is easier to understand and explain than the process whereby it was reached. So I'm going to first show you the answer and then backtrack a little bit to give you some idea of how we got there. So the ultimate theory so far, and probably forever, of protons and neutrons and atomic nuclei is called quantum electrodynamics, quantum chromodynamics, or QCD. It's a vast generalization of the ideas of electrodynamics, where you have charges, positive and negative charges, that attract and repel electric forces, and also the electric forces are associated with photons, and photons can be radiated, so there's a whole complex of ideas in electrodynamics, all of which is carried over and vastly generalized in QCD. In QCD, we have not one kind of charge, that is not one, we have not just one dimension of charge, because they can come, but by one kind of charge, I mean both positive and negative, but just one dimension of charge. We have three totally unrelated charges, three different charges, each of very much related, but definitely different, each of which can come in positive and negative. In any case, the basic constituents of protons and neutrons and these other particles, and the other particles in the zoo that came up in their study, are so-called quarks, which have these three different kinds of charges. And for the particles that occur in atomic nuclei, we only have to worry about two distinct kinds of quarks, each of which comes in three colors, the so-called U quark or up quark, and the D or down quark. And then, so those are, in a way, the analog of electrons in atomic physics. And then, in addition to those, we also have the analog of photons, which are the so-called colored gluons. And colored gluons come in two types, one of which senses these colored charges. So those are these guys. They react to, I should show you the equations of QCD also. So here are the equations. Color is conserved, so if you draw the space-time flow of color in any process, the lines keep going. They never can terminate. I should, of course, keep going here, but I ran out of ink. So a basic interaction would be where one kind of gluon senses another, or a gluon changes one into another, or if I had a purely green one up here, then the gluon which was green and anti-green would be able to sense it without changing its charge. But that's just what a photon does. It senses charge without changing it. So we have those gluons which are analogs of photons, and then other ones which can change one color into another. There's no analog of that in electrodynamics. Photons themselves don't have charge. They have equal, they sense charge but don't carry net charge. They have an equal amount of positive and negative charge, if you like. Now, one way that reflects itself in the physical world is that photons freely pass through each other. That's a very basic element of our experience. If you look through a beam of light, you can cross that ways. You can also see the light coming this way. Light travels in a straight, it doesn't get deflected by other stray light. Many of you have probably seen the movie Star Wars, where there are laser sword fights. But in reality, laser sword fights would be a very disappointing affair. The different sabers would just go right through each other. Light doesn't carry charge, so lightsabers would go right through each other. Of course, that was in a galaxy far, far away, where in many respects their technology was more advanced than in our neighborhood. And I conjecture that they were using colored gluon lasers. In that case, you would get a big bang because of processes like this. Okay, so when I called these the equations of QCD, of course it's something of a joke. These aren't equations, they're just squiggles on paper. But it's not really a joke, because in physics we have absolutely precise rules for associating probabilities or amplitudes, we call them amplitudes in quantum mechanics, for space-time processes in these squiggles. So we can think of this as time and this as space, for instance, and this is a process going on in space-time. We have absolutely precise rules associated with these squiggly lines. These are the so-called Feynman diagrams, and they really express the physical content of the theory completely. But just to show you that I can actually write down equations, And to make an important Pythagorean point, here are the actual equations of QCD. You can notice I can write them down on just a few lines. This tells us how difficult it is to create gluons. And there's a parameter there, which is the strong coupling constant, G. This tells us how quarks move and their masses. So there was an up quark and a down quark. They each have a mass. And there's an overall coupling constant. This was analogous to the fine structure constant that appeared in Bohr's formula. And those are the only non-Pythagorean elements. These formulas look complicated, but everything in them has a conceptual meaning. These complicated indices, these ones are implementing special relativity. These ones are implementing color symmetry. These ones are the Dirac equation, which tells us about spin. Each of those doesn't contain any non-conceptual element. We don't have to make measurements to determine what these numbers are or what these numbers are. They're completely determined by symmetry. So QCD has exactly, apparently, three parameters to define the theory completely, this G and two masses. Now, I don't want you to be too impressed by this, because Feynman has shown that you can actually write all the equations of physics on one line with an even simpler equation, U equals zero. This is an amazing feat of synthesis, but actually it's a complete cheat. I have to tell you what U is. Well, U is called the unworldliness. So the unworldliness is zero in the world. What is the unworldliness? Well, we can give an exact formula for it. For instance, the unworldliness of QCD would be L minus this side, all squared, equals zero. So putting the unworldliness of QCD equals zero would tell you the equations of QCD. The unworldliness of mechanics would be F minus MA squared. So we have unworldliness of mechanics equals zero. You just take the sum of all the unworldlinesses, mechanics, QCD, QED, all the laws of physics, add them together to get the total unworldliness, and the entire content of physics becomes U equals zero. Is that an amazing intellectual feat? Well, not really, because that is a complete cheat. When you unpack U, you just get back what you started with. I just want to reassure you that I'm not cheating that way. These equations are not things that have to be unpacked. It's all up front. All the quantities that appear in here have deep conceptual meanings. The only things that don't have a conceptual origin that have to be taken from measurements are G and two masses. How do we know it's right? Well, we can go to a computer, put in these laws, three, count them three numbers. Oh, actually, in this plot, to have more things to compare with, I also included the strange quark, which governs some of these unstable particles, not important for protons and neutrons. And just let the computer churn away, calculate what the excitations are. The computations actually are exactly the sorts of calculations that I showed you in this atom demonstration. One is looking for stable oscillation patterns of waves of quarks and gluons. They interact with each other, one changes into another, but they can form stable oscillation patterns. The stable oscillation patterns, or the ones that are almost stable, are the ones we call particles, and we identify with things in the world. So if you liked that atomic demonstration, you would love QCD. Unfortunately, it's a much more demanding thing, and there's no shareware program so far that quite does it. In fact, these things tax the most advanced computers in the world, and they have to run for years at a time to get these numbers. But in any case, the result is worth it when you compare the experimental results, the irreducible elements of reality, to the almost ideally Pythagorean calculations with minimal numerical input, just three parameters. You see there's an extraordinary concordance between the masses as predicted and the masses that are actually observed for quite a number of particles. Another thing that comes up here, if we look at it slightly more quantitatively, is that two of the parameters in QCD hardly matter at all. Remember, there were only three. There was the coupling constant, the masses of the up and the down quark. It turns out that those masses, although they're not zero, are very much smaller than the masses of the particles that they're inside. So if we actually, the mass of the gluon is exactly zero, that's part of it. The masses of the up quarks and down quarks are very small compared to the total mass of the proton or the other particles that the up quarks and down quarks are in. So if we consider an idealized version of QCD with the masses of the ups and down quarks equal to zero, so now we have just one parameter, then it fits nature, not exactly, but to better than the 5% level. But we can do better. If we have one parameter, let's see if we can do zero. And this also gives us a chance to discuss the concepts whereby QCD was actually discovered and will be very useful in our other deep considerations to come. So I want to move towards the idea that this coupling constant, this fine structure constant for QCD, the thing that tells you how strong is the attraction between quark and anti-quark, or how strongly gluons respond to colored charges, that parameter G, or this thing is actually G squared over 4 pi, it's essentially the same thing as G, how that comes into play and becomes not just a fixed number, but a dynamical quantity, and ultimately, by some sort of miracle, disappears from the theory altogether. So here's a positive charge. And at this point, I'm not drawing colored charges, but just ordinary electromagnetic charges. And it's moving in space and time. So this one is actually just barely moving in space. It's just sitting there at the same place and living its life as time goes on. Okay. Now, if this weren't a space and a time direction, but two space directions, and the particle weren't in vacuum, weren't in empty space, but in a material, then we could imagine, and the material had atoms in it that could be polarized, that is, had internal structure so that it could be pulled this way and that a little bit, the positive charge here would attract negative charges, that is, electrons, in the atoms and molecules and distort them into these shapes. And you see the effect of it is that the charge is getting screened. Negative charge is accumulating around the positive charge. So if you look far away, you see less positive charge than you would see if you were look up close, because it gets screened away. That was familiar already to Faraday in the mid-19th century. In the 20th century, we learned that apparently empty space in quantum mechanics is actually full of fluctuations, including fluctuations that spontaneously produce particle-antiparticle pairs. And the trajectories in space, these particle and antiparticle pairs only live for a short time, then come back together. If you think about it, what that means in this space-time diagram is that they make little closed shapes. And now you see that these closed shapes will also be distorted by the attraction of a positive charge for the negative charges, exactly the same as what Faraday knew, just with a change of the labels, so to speak. So empty space is a dynamical medium and also screens charge. This makes the coupling constant, the strength of the coupling, a function of the distance at which you measure it. And normally, it would be, as I said, as Faraday knew in electrodynamics, that charges get screened, so that the basic charges of your matter, if you looked at shorter distances, would be larger than the charges you observe at long distances. It takes a lot of charge at the middle to make a relatively small charge far away where you observe it. Now, what happens, we can search for theories, and we can consider different kinds of consistent quantum mechanical theories and see whether they exhibit screening or anti-screening. It turns out that QCD is essentially unique in having the property that things aren't screened, but rather anti-screened. That is, that instead of a charge getting screened as a function of distance, so that a big charge at small distances looks like a small charge at large distances, it only takes a little bit of a charge to start an avalanche, build up anti-screening, and make a large charge at large distances. So this is very non-intuitive behavior. It's what's called asymptotic freedom. It's the reverse of normal behavior. It's not easy to find. And the fact that QCD has this property, plus a basic experimental fact, is what first led us to think that that was the right theory. So let me show you the basic fact. Now, actually, this is with some hindsight. In the early days, the basic facts were much more hidden. But now, you can see the basic facts in a much more simple fashion at higher energy machine accelerators. So I'll show you the simple form. And how, if things had been done in a different order, the experiments directly would have pointed you towards a theory that was very much like electrodynamics, but with the property of asymptotic freedom. So if we collide electrons and positrons at very high energies, as people actually do, you find two classes of events occur, two classes of final states emerging as the result of these collisions. One class is when you produce so-called leptons, particles that don't participate in the nuclear interactions, things like muons, electrons, and so-called tau leptons. And when you produce those, all you get is those leptons, 99% of the time, coming out in opposite directions to conserve total momentum if we're colliding them directly. 1% of the time, reflecting the coupling of photons to these charged particles, a photon gets radiated, and you see three particles emerging in that kind of structure. The other class of events are ones where the particle zoo participates, where all these strongly interacting particles, including protons, neutrons, and things that they resemble and get produced in association with them, come out. And what you see there is quite different, but if you squint a little, starts to look the same. So what you see is not that two particles emerge, but typically many, many particles emerge. However, if you squint a little, because these particles tend to emerge highly collimated, not in every which way direction, but in only two directions, it looks like this one. And that happens about 90% of the time when you have the strongly anti-terrific particles, strongly interacting particles. About 9% of the time, you find something that looks like this when you squint. You see three jets. So the obvious interpretation would be that the underlying deep structure of these things is just the same, that these two jets are associated with underlying particles of simple structure moving in opposite directions, but these particles somehow have to get dressed into the observed particles in such a way that their direction, the direction of energy and momentum flow, doesn't get changed much. If the energy and momentum flow got highly distorted, they would go every which way. But if the energy, if the rearrangements only involve small transfers of energy and momentum, although you create many particles, they're all moving in the same direction, and this flow is preserved. And then similarly, you would have occasionally radiation and a three-jet structure. Now, what asymptotic freedom explains is why you can have lots of soft radiation, why you will have lots of soft radiation, whereas radiation that changes the flow a lot will be very rare. That's because the basic particles, remember, have very, very little charge in the middle. So when you deflect those, the gluon doesn't care very much, and gluons won't get radiated very much. You can't radiate something by deflecting the particles, because the particles, the basic particles, have very little charge. However, these particles are the seed of an instability. They grow clouds around themselves. So these clouds grow and materialize as jets instead of single particles. You can make all this extremely quantitative and precise . And by now, there are dozens of experiments, each involving hundreds of independent measurements, that verify this kind of prediction based on jets and many other related phenomena. So what does all this have to do with the Pythagorean theme? Well, we seem to have one parameter, this coupling constant. But now we learn that this coupling constant depends on where you measure it. You measure it at different energies or different distances, and you find that it has a different value. So you can pick any value you want, and it's realized somewhere. You can trade the value of that parameter for the length of your meter stick, if you like. You can calibrate your meter stick by where the coupling constant is equal to, say, a tenth. So again, instead of having a parameter that tells you that there are many, many different theories, you find that there's just one theory measured in different units. And so instead of QCD having three parameters, it contains just these two. And even these two, I told you, are not very important quantitatively. By the way, one consequence of this that's truly remarkable is that we're getting mass without mass. We're constructing protons, neutrons, and all these other particles in the particle zoo from particles, the up and down quarks and gluons, which themselves have almost zero mass. How can that be? Where is the mass coming from? Well, you've undoubtedly all heard of the equation E equals mc squared. And you may also have heard of Ohm's law, V equals IR. But in the Army, they teach you that there are three forms of Ohm's law. There's V equals IR, there's I equals V divided by R, and this R equals V divided by I. Similarly, E equals mc squared can also be read as m equals e divided by c squared, which gives us the possibility of finding mass from pure energy. And that's what actually happens in QCD. There's energy associated with these vibrating wave patterns, with quarks and gluons moving around. The particles are massless, but it's the energy of these vibrations that makes the masses of protons and neutrons, and most of our mass, because we are those things. So, putting it all together, the numerical recipe for ordinary matter contains four parameters, four ingredients: the mass of the electron, the fine structure constant, which gives you chemistry with no motion, and then the parameters up and down quark masses of QCD, which together with the structure of QCD give you protons and neutrons and things that have finite mass and can move, and determines the structure of those nuclei. It's a remarkable achievement of 20th century physics to reduce the description of ordinary matter to purely conceptual elements and just this absolutely minimal number of measured ingredients. Now, my colleagues in other branches of physics sometimes get annoyed with the idea that this is the recipe for matter, and the rest is just filling in the details. But I think that's a profoundly wrong attitude, of course. It's as if in music we had now learned how to make all the notes. Okay, we can make the individual particles, we can analyze simple situations, but nature sounds chords for us sometimes with complicated materials, and ultimately we'd also like to compose our own symphonies. So this is understanding the ingredients is not the end of physics, but even the physics of ordinary matter, but brings a new kind of emphasis to it. So much for ordinary matter. If we want to go beyond ordinary matter to do astrophysics, we can do that with exactly two more ingredients. And I'll just quickly show you that. Radioactivity and the power of energy in stars and changing one element into another requires one more ingredient. You have to know the rate at which so-called weak processes can occur. So that's the so-called Fermi constant. So if we want to understand stars and radioactivity, we have to introduce one more non-conceptual element. But it can be summarized, like the QCD processes, in terms of a Feynman graph, and we just have to know one overall normalization, and then everything else comes out of it. And finally, there's the oldest force of all, gravity. And to introduce it, we need one more parameter. We need to know how strong the gravitational force is. We have to know so-called Newton's constant. Or in general relativity, we have to know where energy and momentum curve space-time, we have to know the conversion factor between energy momentum and curvature and space-time curvature. Curvature is measured in units of inverse length squared, has very different units from energy. We need a conversion factor. We need another honorary number, and that's Newton's constant. Well, taking Newton's constant as an honorary number opens up a whole new can of worms. And in view of the time, I probably don't want to get too deeply into that can of worms. But Let me conclude then by summarizing where we could go from here if we had more time. I've shown you how to reduce the description of the world in principle, and at the most basic reductionist level, to an extraordinarily small number of non-conceptual elements plus some very impressive concepts. But now that physicists have learned that this is possible, they become more and more ambitious. And each time we can reduce the number, so once we're down to a number of constants like 6 or 7, each time you can reduce it by 1, it marks an epoch in physics. Now, I've just indicated to you how we can do that, in a sense, in the case of gravity, by declaring it, the gravitational constant, to be an honorary number. But then we have to revisit the question, because it's the conversion factor between curvature and energy. But then we have to revisit the question of why gravity is as feeble as it is. Well, that question can be answered, but maybe I'd better leave it for another time. Or for questions. Thank you. Oh, well, I can say a bit. I'm happy to say a little bit more, yeah. Okay, sure. I can, well, yeah. Okay. So let me explain then why gravity is so weak. Well, first of all, if we say that gravity is really an honorary number, we're in kind of a box. If we then turn around and say that gravity is very weak, compared to what? It is what it is, all right? That's like saying 2 is small. Well, 2 is small compared to something, but not 2 is what it is. It's not actually, the Greeks had a heck of a time with this concept that something could be both small and large. But that's that's another story. In any case, we now know that it's silly to ask if something is small without saying small compared to what. Oh, first of all, maybe I should say what I mean by saying that gravity is extremely feeble. At a basic, we think the basic interactions between particles are between the elementary particles. And so, for instance, we should ask about what's the ratio of the force of gravity between quarks, or protons even, and the stronger electromagnetic forces. That's a fair comparison because both are 1 over r squared type forces, and we can just ask what's the ratio of those forces. And it turns out that if you divide the strength of the gravitational force by the strength of a strong or electromagnetic force, you get a number which is 1 followed by something like 40 zeros. So that's the sense in which gravity is very, very small. It's hard to conceive of 40 zeros. You take this and then a tenth and then a tenth and a tenth. You can do maybe the first few steps, but 40 of them, believe me, it's an impressively small number. So gravity on atomic scales and subatomic scales is completely negligible, and that's why I neglected it, like all particle physicists, in describing the structure of matter. But now we're saying that that's the basic number. And we have to ask that the strength of gravity is a basic parameter. It's an honorary number. It is what it is. So the physical fact about the world, that the force of gravity is very feeble, has to be understood in a different way. Well, the force of gravity between protons is proportional not only to Newton's constant, which is a number, an honorary number, but also to the proton's mass. So the question really should be phrased is, why is the proton mass so small? That's a sensible question. Small compared to what? Well, small compared to the mass described by gravity. Well, I should backtrack a second. We now have 3 honorary numbers: Planck's constant, which was the honorary number from quantum mechanics, the speed of light, which was the honorary number from special relativity, and now Newton's constant, which becomes an honorary number in general relativity. With these three honorary numbers, we can construct a complete system of units for physics. You probably are familiar with the idea that in units of physics, you need mass, you need a unit of mass, you need a unit of length, and you need a unit of time. What mass, length, time, that makes three. So you need three different things to make units. Well, Newton's constant, the speed of light, and Planck's constant are also three units, and it shouldn't be surprising that you can construct a complete system of units, including a length, a time, and a mass from those three honorary numbers, and you can. So then we have a unit of mass constructed purely from these honorary numbers, and that's something called the Planck mass, and it turns out to be about 10 to the 33rd proton masses. I'm sorry, 10 to the 18th proton masses. I was squaring it. Not accurately either, but it's about 10 to the 18th proton masses. So that's the precise quantitative statement of the idea that protons are anomalously light. They're light compared to the natural honorary number unit, and it's directly from that effect that the feebleness of gravity on atomic scales follows. So why are protons so light? Well, I've spent a lot of time in this lecture telling you where the proton mass came from. Okay. It came from these interactions of quarks and gluons. Now, and I also emphasize to you that the strength of the interactions of quarks and gluons depended on the distance and was very feeble at small distances because of the, and grew at large distances due to the anti-screening or asymptotic freedom. So if the basic unit of length is the Planck length, or if the basic unit of energy is the Planck energy, really the basic unit of strong interaction, the place where we should measure the strength of the strong interaction is at that energy or at that length. If we do that, we find it's a moderately small number. Not terribly small, but moderately small. That's way out here in this picture at some very, very large energy, which corresponds to a very, very short distance. Now, the coupling you see is the running of the coupling levels out here. And so for even a moderately small value of the coupling at the Planck scale, it takes a very, very long time for its strength to accumulate until it's capable of holding these wave patterns together and making protons. So it turns out that a number, if we put that number g that appears in QCD equal to a half, or so at the Planck scale, and see when it makes protons, then it makes protons at the right place. So the fact that protons are so extraordinarily light that compared to the natural unit of mass, they have 10 to the minus 18th, 10, 1 followed by 18 zeros smaller mass, follows from the fact that that coupling happens to be a half at the basic scale. That takes the mystery out of why protons are so light. Now we just have to understand why at the Planck scale it's a half. But that's a much easier problem. That seems to us a much more reasonable problem than where in the heck could a number like 10 to the minus 18th come from. So the answer to why protons are so light is that before the coupling constant really starts to run and take off, it has to walk for a long time and build up strength. And now maybe it isn't an appropriate time to stop, although I could say a lot more about why we think this is true and how it holds together and how it leads to a brilliant future for physics, but I'll let you have a chance to ask me those things.
Recently, there's a word that the Planck constant may vary with time.
Yes.
So that means.
Well, let me repeat the question in case people didn't hear. Recently, there's been some suggestions from astronomical observations that perhaps this fine structure constant of electrodynamics may have been different in the very early universe. And then the question is, would that mean that also the corresponding fine structure constant or corresponding coupling in QCD would change with time? And the answer is, well, let me give a several-part answer. The first and most important part is that the so-called evidence for that the fine structure constant was different in the early universe is very tenuous. And personally, I think it's almost surely wrong. Secondly, if it did vary, then we would need to develop a theory of why it varied. It's possible to cook up little models that accommodate that variation, but I think all physicists that I know would agree that there's no profound theory that leads to expectations that the coupling constant should change by the amount that's claimed. But then the third part of the question is, if it were to be observed that it's changing, would that also mean that the QCD coupling is changing? The answer is we can't tell for sure without a profound theory. But because, in parts I didn't show you, we've learned that the different parts of physics, in particular, especially QCD and QED, are very much unified. That they're not separate theories, but form part of a larger whole, that almost surely if the fine structure constant were changing, then the QCD coupling constant would also be changing. And that's actually one of the reasons to doubt these observations, because you can see what the effects of the QCD coupling changing would be, and they would be pretty catastrophic. They would contradict others.
So when you physicists are finally done,
yes.
How many non-numbers or non-honorary numbers do you personally think there will be?
Let me give a nuanced answer to that question. I think that at the level of equations, we'll keep striving until we find equations that have no non-numerical. No non-conceptual elements. However, at the level of describing the world, in other words, what solutions of the equations describe our world, I think it's quite possible that we'll need to take input, because different parts of the universe might very well have different conditions that would reflect themselves as different values of some of the parameters. Well, I tried to give the nuanced answer. The nuanced answer is that they're arbitrary in the sense that they could have different values in different places. And so there's an element of historical conditioning, or if you like, an element of where we happen to be. It's a similar question, actually, to what faced Kepler. Kepler would have liked to think that the solar system was so extraordinary and so unique that the shapes and sizes of the orbits had to be determined by fundamental principles. But now we've learned to be, if not happy with, at least familiar with the idea that we're not so special, and that different parts of the world see different kinds of solar systems. And what I think is a very real possibility is that similarly, parameters that might appear fundamental, that might, say, govern masses of heavier quarks or mixings between different details of things that people discover at accelerators, may be quite different in different parts of the world.
Isn't it some type of a fixed point theorem here that we are here to observe these constants? We evolved from the same thing. So the fact that we are here to observe this, you'll only be observing what exactly, there's only one point there that you would observe.
No, it's far from trivial. Let me describe this in three different. Let me describe it in three different aspects. First of all, the conditions for our existence, I think, could be comfortably satisfied if we had a region of the size of the solar system, or certainly our galaxy, that had the parameters we have. But Andromeda, say, would have 10% larger value of the fine structure constant, or distant galaxies could have different properties. It wouldn't destroy the possibility of observation. So I think it's a very, very non-trivial observational fact about the universe that the parts we've seen do seem to have, at least more or less, the same fundamental constants. Another question is whether there's an element of tautology in the principle that, this is what's called the anthropic principle, that the fact that we observe things means that things have to be as we observe them. Well, stated that way, it is a tautology. But the more powerful statement, and so it's kind of empty, but the more powerful statement of the anthropic principle, which is what usually people mean, is that the conditions for any kind of intelligent life or any kind of interpretation of the world, any kind of sentience, puts constraints on the values of fundamental parameters. And it undoubtedly does put constraints on many parameters. I don't find it plausible that, for instance, it tells you much about the top quark mass or many other parameters that appear to be fundamental in physics, but it probably does put some constraints on the fundamental parameters, so that if it were true that different parts of the universe, really by historical accident, so to speak, had different values of the fundamental parameters, then some of them wouldn't be suitable for life, and we could derive relations among these parameters that would be valid in all the regions that were suitable for life based on that principle. But we're nowhere near that level yet.
What is the next experiment or observation you would like to see performed to attack or to confirm parts of this grand description?
You've given me a great opening now. So I will answer that question in some detail. I've discussed quite a bit the theory of the strong interaction, QCD, and alluded to the simpler version, quantum electrodynamics. That, together with the theory of the so-called weak interaction, which I also mentioned in connection with beta decay and stellar burning, is the so-called standard model. And it describes, simplifying only slightly, it describes everything we know about matter. And the standard model can be described without great loss, by what's above the line here. I won't try to explicate these symbols, but just to say that that's the standard model. That includes everything we know about matter in some sense. Well, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but it's an innocent exaggeration. Now, that's pretty economical. It's not quite U equals zero, but it's pretty economical. However, if you think that this is getting close to the ultimate laws of nature, it's a little disappointing to have five different pieces and also some funny subscripts, which are numbers. So one would like to do better. And what emerges if you try to do better, and I really can't do justice to this without considerable more mathematics, but I can show you the picture, if you like, give you a feeling for it. What emerges is that if you examine these little pieces and try to put them together, it turns out that you can assemble them in an almost unique way into something that looks like a jewel. In other words, you find these pieces that have different funny sizes and shapes. If you put them together, you find that they fit together into a beautifully symmetric, more perfect object. That's called a unified symmetry, unified field theory. And this structure, which is kind of haphazard and taken from experiment, although tremendously impressive when you unfold it, can be assembled into this structure, where you have not just the red, white, and blue colors of QCD, and two extra colors to make five altogether, all on a democratic footing, and all possible assignments of plus 1/2 and minus 1/2 charge. You find all the particles we observe and only the particles we observe in this pattern. And it's extraordinarily beautiful when you unpack it. So it suggests that there's a basic symmetry that extends the partial symmetries of the standard model, the symmetries among the different colors of QCD and other related things in weak interaction, that put them all in together into one shining jewel. However, to really have symmetry, you need to do one more thing. To really have symmetry, to really have all the different colors being on the same footing, the response of the different gluons, the different particles, to those different colors has to be equally strong for each. But there's a reason why the strong interaction is called a strong interaction, why quarks need a different description than electrons. That is that the QCD interaction, as we observe it, is actually big. It is the strong interaction. It's a bigger interaction than the weak interaction or electromagnetism. So this fit, although it fits at the level of the numbers of the particles and their charges, superficially seems to fail at the level of the strength of interaction. But, as I've told you, a great lesson of QCD is that the strength of a coupling depends on where you measure it. And really, the fundamental interactions, the basic charges, before they build up these clouds, are at short distances that we haven't measured, and we have to extrapolate to find out whether they're in fact equal. Now, it turns out that the techniques we developed in QCD can be used to address this general problem, see how all the different couplings run. And you can start with values from experiment down here, from accelerators, and calculate the behavior of the polarization cloud, theoretically see how the charges thicken or thin out as you go towards the middle. And what you find is that if you only include the effects of the virtual particles we know about for sure, it almost but not quite works. However, if you include an extension of the standard model to include what's called supersymmetry, which is another a beautiful, well-motivated extension of the standard model, then they really do unify. So supersymmetry makes many, many predictions about what should be seen at the next higher energy round of accelerators, in particular at the Large Hadron Collider, which should open in CERN in a few years. It predicts that there should be basically, for every particle we know about, another so-called supersymmetric particle, partner of it, which, well, I'll tantalize you, can be thought of as the result of moving that particle into a quantum, an extra quantum direction of space-time. So the idea that there's unification, that the couplings run, makes contact with my other discussion of why gravity is feeble. Gravity also fits on this graph. I'll explain this further if someone asks me. And so we can test these ideas, or we will be very encouraged in pursuing these ideas if supersymmetry shows up at the next level of accelerator. And if not, well, we'll have to think harder. What's what? These are inverse couplings, yeah. So this is the fine structure constant of QCD. 1 over the fine structure constant of QCD. This is 1 over the fine structure constant of not quite electrodynamics, but almost. And this is 1 over the fine structure constant of the weak interaction, which I didn't really discuss. That's another element of the standard model.
Could you say anything about, at a fundamental level, the role of randomness in these considerations?
I could say a couple of things. That's an open invitation. Well, one thing I should say is that all of this structure is firmly built on the foundations of quantum mechanics. So its success, to me, means that quantum mechanics, with its inherent randomness that made so many people uncomfortable in the early days, is really here to stay. The other thing to say is that, other than that, it doesn't look random at all. The laws are very precise. The equations get worked out very precisely. Concepts like chaos don't play an important role in any of these calculations. There was a lot of ballyhoo about chaos as a new paradigm of science, et cetera, but it certainly hasn't infected these considerations. And the way I feel about it is, do I look fuzzy to you? when we look around, the remarkable thing is how much precise structure there is. And, the fact that you can make complicated computer graphics really doesn't change that fact.
Well, just a brief question. Yes. In your book of recipes, yes. You forgot to mention Pauli's principle, because the way we look and the way the world looks also relies on that rule.
Yes.
And
oh, no.
Could you make any comments on, so to say, that at some level the role of fermions and bosons could be floppy?
Yeah. Okay, I'll say a couple of things. Maybe a more honest title would be The Ingredients of the World's Numerical Recipe, but that was kind of a mouthful. I talked here just about what the basic elements are. I haven't discussed how you cook them, so to speak, what the procedures and algorithms are in any depth. So underlying all of this are the principles of quantum mechanics and relativity and their fusion into relativistic quantum field theory. I didn't discuss it, but that's definitely the foundations on which we're building. And that includes Pauli's principle and many other things. The other question was, the relation of fermions and bosons. Well, supersymmetry. Yeah. So in the description of matter, there are details of the particles besides just their colors that are very crucial to their behavior. One important distinction is between particles with different amounts of intrinsic spin. And another one that turns out to be deeply related to that is that roughly half the particles, well, why should I say roughly half? The quarks and the electrons and several other particles are what's called fermions, whereas the photons and the gluons are what's called bosons. And fermions are, roughly speaking, particles that don't like to be pressed together. And so they give pressure and they give stability to matter. The bosons are things that do like to be pressed together, like photons like to congeal into lasers. And those seem to be very, very different. And in the framework of physics to date, in the standard model, they just appear on a very different footing. However, in this last idea I talked about, in supersymmetry, that question really does get addressed. In supersymmetry, there's a fundamental relationship, a fundamental symmetry relation that relates fermions to bosons. It's motion in these extra quantum directions. So that dichotomy between fermions and bosons, which perhaps looked like something that could never be unified, could never be resolved, I think is tantalizingly close now.
Okay, unless you want to ask yourself a question.
Well, all right.
Let's thank Frank for one. I invite you all to join us for refreshments in the common room down the hall.